think all of us understand that religion is a motivating factor in our world today. There is a great deal of interest and discussion on all sides of faith, all types of denominations and religious interests. It's dominating our news, so much so that very often you will see one of the major news weeklies come out with a cover story on religion or on the Bible or on Jesus Christ or something about New Testament Christianity. You will see a great deal of discussion about it. And as much as some people would like to see religion go away, it just hasn't happened. There was a period of time in the 20th century, now just a few years ago, in the mid-1960s, Time magazine came out with their famous headline that God is dead. And that was more of a hope than a reality. And I think it reflected the desire of a certain segment of the intelligentsia and society that they could nail the coffin shut on religion and God. But that didn't happen. And with all of our advances, with all that has taken place in our modern world, that religion is still playing a very, very major role in world affairs and is going to play an even larger role. Bible prophecy tells us that. So there's always a great deal of discussion about it. The impact upon us is very relevant as well. We have gone through our own wars of religion in our own time, and we've had to be vigilant and very much watching what takes place in our own house in terms of doctrine and teaching. We've lived through times like that, and we understand that. There is a great deal of struggle and controversy that is taking place in the spiritual realm, and observing what's taking place in the world around us is also instructive for many things within the church, but certainly when it comes to understanding events that are going to transpire in Bible prophecy. Let me walk you through a few of those as we move along here and talk about some of the things that are taking place and what is shaping our world, what is being discussed in the headlines and in the news stories in this area of religion and its impact on the world. I think all of you recognize this face of the Dalai Lama from the head of Tibetan Buddhism. The Dalai Lama is a very beloved figure among a very large segment of people, especially in America. He was recently in my home state of Indiana a few months ago and made a pilgrimage there. His brother lives in Bloomington, Indiana, not too far from where we are. And he visited there and spoke, and he draws a tremendous crowd. But he is a figure of peace, as he is revered as a holy figure. But I think you'll realize that Tibet has been occupied for a number of years by communist China. And what is interesting, at least just to note in this particular area, what's taking place here is recently I read that the communist Chinese outlawed transubstantiation, unauthorized transubstantiation. Now, that's rather, I think you realize that that's a major tenet of Buddhism, that when one dies, they come back in another form. And the Dalai Lama here feels, he's even speculated what he might come back as after he dies. And he is a reincarnated figure from the past as well. But the Chinese, in order to control Tibetan Buddhism, which is something they've not really been able to control, and of course he's been exiled from Tibet for a number of years, they recently came up with a law that they outlawed unauthorized transubstantiation. So that, in other words, the basis of the law is that the next Dalai Lama cannot be born in Tibet, must be born in China. So it's ironic that the communist Chinese are trying to control Buddhism in that particular way, but it demonstrates the power of religion and the fact that even communism, godless atheism, has not been able to squelch it out in China. And particularly in this particular area of Tibetan Buddhism, it's taken it to that particular extreme. A few weeks ago, there was a British school teacher in Sudan who decided within her classroom to name a teddy bear Muhammad, and it created a great deal of controversy and almost cost her life. I think we all remember that. And she had to return to England, and fortunately, that story had a good ending, as she didn't lose her life. But the the fervor that she aroused in that particular schoolroom effort at teaching, again, just demonstrates the passion that people have in parts of the world, especially the Muslim faith, of anything that would denigrate their prophet, and that they would put the idea of putting a name on a teddy bear of the prophet Muhammad to them would be sacrilegious. But it stirs up the strong feelings and the strong passion that particular event did there. A few years ago in Iraq, this shrine up here, a Shiite shrine, one of the holiest relics and places among the Shiite faction of Islam. And I think we've all come to had to learn terms of Sunni and Shiite, and at least we've heard those terms, and we may or may not be able to tell the distinction and explain the distinction between a Sunni Muslim and a Shiite Muslim. But this was a Shiite mosque, and it was destroyed by a group of Sunnis. So even within the Muslim community, there are these strong tides of passion rolling against one another, creating the problems that our American forces have dealt with in recent years in Iraq and trying to pacify that country. And of course, as they fight among themselves, this is the result, and just demonstrates the strong passion and emotion that is there within the Muslim community, that they would bomb a very holy site of the Shiite faith. Very, very common in the sectarian violence that has taken place there in Iraq, that has been stirred up, and is also a big story in the Islamic world and among the nations of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and understanding the politics and things that take place on an ongoing basis there. A little over a year ago, Pope Benedict the 16th, shown right here and talking with a group of Muslims in this particular photo, but when the Pope was giving a speech in Germany, in September of last year, he referenced a historical comment made by one of the caliphs of the Ottoman Empire, and talking about Islam, actually the Byzantine Empire. He was talking about Islam at the time. This was before Byzantium had fallen, and talking about the violent nature of the Islamic faith. And he spoke out in that, and it created a tremendous uproar within the Muslim world against the Pope. And you're not used to seeing that type of an uproar against the figure of the Pope at Rome, but he really stepped into it. Now, I think fully he knew exactly what he was saying, and he knew exactly what the result would be in terms of the uproar. He made somewhat of an apology. You know, sometimes apologies are made that are not really apologies, and I think the Pope made a statement that seemed to pacify things for a time. But he knows what he thinks about Islam, and as opposed to the Christian faith. But it created this tremendous uproar at that particular point in time, and between Islam and Christianity, and at least these faces here, and demonstrates the very, very strong feelings that are underneath the surface in this part of the world. And of course, we have seen this clash of Islam and Christianity more talked about in recent years, since 9/11, with what has taken place. And we've all probably raised our level of awareness about the Muslim faith since those events have taken place. And as I said a minute ago, about even knowing the difference between the Sunnis and the Shiites and what has happened there. So we've had to deal with that. On the other side of the coin, there are those obviously that have no faith and are atheistic. But we've also seen a tremendous amount of interest and discussion from the atheists in recent months as they attack religion. Their attacks upon religion have increased, and it really have reached very strident heights. There's a form of militant atheism that has come out, represented by these three books that have been on the bestseller list for months. The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins up here on the top. This book, God Is Not Great, by Christopher Hitchens, the subtitle is How Religion Poisons Everything. And then a third book, A Letter to a Christian Nation by Sam Harris. All three of these books, Hitchens and Dawkins are British, and Harris is, I believe, American. But these have been books on the bestseller list in recent months that have highlighted the atheistic point of view as they have now gone on to begin to attack religion and promote their form of atheism. And in reading about it, I've scanned this book. I've read Hitchens' book, and I've not looked at this one here. But there is a very strong anger at religion and God and the organized forms of religion of all kinds, not just Christianity. And though atheism at least in America, represents a very, very small portion of the overall American population, it nonetheless has garnered a great deal of attention. Probably there are more atheists in more influential positions of academia and media than there are the middle class and other levels of American society. More than 90% of Americans profess to believe in God. We are a Bible-believing nation. We are known as a religious nation, at least nominally. But these books and these attacks gain a great deal of notoriety and are very, very strong today. And it's been a new strain. We did a program on Beyond Today on the new atheism a few months ago. This face is a familiar one, more so in recent weeks probably. Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, who is running for the Republican nomination for president. Now, Mr. Huckabee is a ordained Baptist minister, and he has surged in the polls in Iowa in recent days, and that has vaulted his candidacy and his efforts to the top of the charts and the polls and created a great deal of attention for him. Otherwise, most of us would never have known who he was and really would not have paid much attention to him. But what is interesting is that his candidacy and the interest in his candidacy and the popularity that he's recently gotten has come from the very strong Christian conservative evangelical base in Iowa, and because of their interest there and what he is saying. And I'm not wanting to get to comment and get into his faith and the elements of that. That's not the point here. But it shows, again, the very strong strain of religion that runs in American politics. And what is stirred up, American religion has made a very strong push in politics since the 1970s, when they were beginning to be a part of the election that brought Jimmy Carter to the presidency. And then especially in 1980, when Ronald Reagan became president, the evangelical Christian fundamentalist base was more organized and very influential in American politics from 1980 on for a number of years. There was some talk going into this election cycle that it might not be as strong, but at least we're seeing certain strengths that are coalescing around this particular man in Iowa. I don't know how far it will go. I personally wonder if he'll have the ability to really stand the exposure and the strain on a national level once he gets out of these early primaries. But I'm not a political pundit. I'm not trying to make predictions here, but I'm just commenting on the interest of religion, the impact of religion in this particular area as well. And then, of course, there is the other candidate, one of the other Republican candidates, Mr. Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, who is a Mormon, member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And his Mormonism has become an object of examination now, quite strongly. And again, the tenets of his faith are one thing. The character of the man is built upon that. And from all accounts, he is a successful person. He is a moral individual. Some of his political views may have shifted back and forth on certain subjects. I don't want to get into all of that. But what I found interesting was an interview that was done with him last week by Tim Russert on Meet the Press. And Tim Russert took, the full program, full hour, and interviewed Mitt Romney. And it seemed like he spent the first 20 minutes, 25 minutes, zeroing in on a particular part of the Mormon belief that was held until the early 1970s, where the Mormons refused to admit blacks into their membership. And Tim Russert made a major point about that and really questioned him. I think Mitt Romney explained his personal feeling about race and the subject, and how he and his father, another governor of Michigan, George Romney, how they had felt about that and their personal approach to it. But nonetheless, there was this doctrine, this teaching of the Mormon Church that held until the early 70s in terms of black membership. Now, I haven't researched exactly all the theological tenets of it to know even if it is still held. I think some feel that it may still deep down in the bowels of the teachings of the Mormon Church, it still may be something that is held there. But I think they have also made some inroads, and they do have black membership. But it took them until the 1970s to make that change, and Tim Russert was really pounding that point home. He could just as easily have gone after the Catholic Church for not allowing women into the priesthood, or the Methodist Church for not allowing gays into their ministry. Again, not that I'm saying that either should be done, but here's the fundamental point that I think is important for us to understand, is that every church in America is free to hold whatever belief they have. We have our unique, distinctive beliefs, and we have the freedom of religion guaranteed by the American Constitution to hold such belief. And we are very grateful for that. We should be. And we have that separation of church and state in the United States, and that is a very critical part of our success as a nation and for the ability of the Church of God to preach the gospel and for us to believe as we do. And Americans of all walk of life have the freedom to choose where they want to worship or where they don't want to worship. That's part of the freedom as well. And that's, you know, we certainly would hold a feeling that people should worship God in truth and in spirit and in truth. But we're grateful for the freedoms that we have. It's when those freedoms begin to be scrutinized, and it really disturbed me as I watched Tim Russert really zero in on the Mormon Church for their particular belief. Now, I don't agree with that belief. Most Americans don't. But I would agree that they at least under the Constitution had the freedom to hold that belief. And it's when that freedom is taken away that all churches will have a problem, including us. We've had our own scrapes and issues and seen how close that can come when government comes in and begins to decide and dictate to a church in our own history in the past. And we don't ever want to see that happen. That's one of the fundamentals of the English-speaking peoples, and particularly American religion, American society, that is unique and very, very important. But when I saw the scrutiny that at least the Mormon Church was getting for that, I thought that was a bit unfair, because Mr. Russert or any other newsman could go after the Catholic Church or the Methodist or others because of their beliefs. Not that they should, but when that becomes a part of the political discussion, it sends up warning signals for me. And I don't like to see that. Mitt Romney or any other Mormon is free to believe whatever they want about the Mormon faith. I choose not to believe it. You do as well. But that's why we're here. But when we see those things begin to take place, then it should begin to send up certain signals. Now, I'm not saying that we are heading off in America into a direction where we're going to tear down that wall of church and state. We're going to have a state-controlled religion, or the state is going to get involved in dictating to the churches. I don't think we're anywhere near that. But you want to understand when those things begin to take place that at least there are certain strains that the Bible talks about that begin to echo in those discussions that one should be very much aware of. This is a map that shows some of the strife that is religious strife that has hit the entire world. And you'll see that most of it seems to be here in Africa and the Middle East and parts of Asia, in terms of areas where there have been interdenominational conflict and religion-linked terrorist attacks. That's what these particular stars represent. You got one up here in Britain, which represents the subway bombings of a couple of years ago, the railway bombings in Spain a few years ago as well, terrorist attacks there. Down here in Sudan, you've got an interdenominational conflict that is destroying Darfur and that area right here. But all of these are areas of religious conflict around the world. Way over here in America, you've got New York and Washington, which represents the attacks on 9/11 for us. We have not escaped religious conflict and strife, even way over here. But it is instructive to see the boundary of the Atlantic Ocean and what that has meant, and where so much of this has been concentrated in this part of the world. It just illustrates that our world is still very much embroiled in religious conflict, religious war, and interdenominational wars and terrorist attacks that are inspired because of religious fundamentalism of all different stripes. This is just current. Now, we could go back a few decades and bring in problems in Northern Ireland. They're not even mentioned on this particular map. This is one that's just more current to right now. But it just illustrates the fact that religion hasn't gone away. And as enlightened and modern as our world has become, as global as we have become in this global economy, religion is still a very strong force that is going to be an even stronger force in the coming years ahead. I want to read you a quote and ask you, give you a choice as to who you think said this particular quote. And it's just a very short, simple quote regarding religion, but I think it's illustrated by this map. And this person said, "The world is gravitating towards faith in the Almighty." The world is gravitating towards faith in the Almighty. Now, who do you think might have said that? A, Billy Graham. B, George Bush. C, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Or D, the Dalai Lama. How many of you think Billy Graham said that? Okay, how many of you think George Bush said that? How many of you think Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that? More of you. How many of you think the Dalai Lama said that? The rest of you don't care. No opinion. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that in a recent letter to George Bush. He said, "The world is gravitating towards faith in the Almighty." Religion's not going away. Now, how they define the Almighty and God and the superior being, deity, how they define that is all going to be, according to whether it's Muslim or Christian or Buddhist faith, but the world is growing and developing in that way. Africa is burgeoning with Christianity. So is China. I mean, there are some statements that within a few years, China could become the largest Christian nation in the world. There was talk that Pope John Paul II, before he died, might have secretly consecrated a Chinese cardinal that was not revealed. I don't know, that's never been talked about since his death, but the last group of cardinals that he made before he died, they speculated because he kept one secret for himself, and it may have been someone in, speculation was that it may have been in China. But Christianity is growing in not only the developing world, but the developed world. And we're going to see more and more of this as we go forward. Which brings us to the biblical story of a group called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse that we read about in the book of Revelation that helps us to understand particularly the first horseman of the apocalypse, the white horseman, of the seal of Revelation chapter 6 that is mentioned here, that deals with the writer that represents religion, false religion, in Scripture. In Revelation chapter 6, in verse 1, John at this point in the story, in the Revelation, says, "I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, with a voice like thunder, 'Come and see.'" In Revelation 6, the seals are begun to be opened, and they are opened by the Lamb. And the Lamb is Jesus Christ. We're just have that described for us in chapter 5 of Revelation, in verse 5, where as John sees this here and beginning to see these things open and these trials come on, he is told, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals." When we come to these end time events that are pictured by the four horsemen of Revelation chapter 6, we always have to begin in chapter 5 and understand that they are all opened, they are all controlled by Jesus Christ. He knows exactly when they are going to ride. He controls the length and the extent of their ride. Again, Christ is in charge of the revelation. Christ is in charge of the apocalypse. Now, it's something perhaps we should think about at this time of year as the world focuses upon the image of Jesus lying as a babe in a manger. that really does a great deal to take away from the real image of Christ that we have from the Bible, and especially in the book of Revelation. Chapter 1 of Revelation, we find Jesus standing in the midst of the seven churches, and his face shines like the sun, and his voice is like the sound of many rushing waters. He's a very powerful being. He's in charge of his church. He has the messages for his churches, and he is in charge of history. When we come down to Revelation chapter 5, and we begin to look at what we are told here in these unfolding events of the time of the end, we are comforted and encouraged by the fact that Jesus is in charge of these events. He opens the scrolls. He is the one who has foretold them all. And the story really begins back in Matthew chapter 24 of the Olivet Prophecy. When Jesus went out from the temple, they crossed over the Kidron Valley, and they went on to the Mount of Olives. And his disciples wanted to know what would be the signs of his coming and of the end of the age. And Jesus began to talk to them and to explain. And the very first thing that he said, and I could just turn back to Matthew 24, and you can turn back with me, and it might be good for us to read that, what he said, Matthew chapter 24, beginning in verse 4. Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." Now, this was the first sign that Jesus gave on the Mount of Olives, in the Olivet Prophecy. It ties in with this first horseman of Revelation chapter 6, the horseman of false religion. He said that many will come in my name saying, "I am the Christ," and will deceive many. Then he goes on to talk about wars and rumors of wars and the other horseman. The second horseman is war, and we're not talking about that one today. But the very first thing that Jesus gave as a sign of the time of the end, of the end of the age, was religious deception. People saying that they represented God, that they had the true path to God, to Christ, in whether it's the Christian form or some other form. They had the final revelation given by their prophet, given by their religious sage, and they would then deceive many. And again, you begin to get the picture and the image of religious ferment and religious turmoil continuing down into this particular period. It was something that Jesus went on and gave through his disciples, and the disciples in many references in Acts 20 and 2 Peter and in John talked about the warnings of false teaching that would creep into the church. The story of the church in the early decades, particularly in the early decades, at least where we have the biblical record of the apostles, is a struggle against false teaching. It is always important that the church be kept pure doctrinally in terms of its teaching. Our lives are a work in progress. We may not be pure at every point in our life. We strive to come up to the teachings and to the character of God. But it is important that the church have its teaching correct, and that it be teaching correct doctrine in all aspects of God and how to worship God and how to love one another and all of those things. But they struggled with that in the early decades of the first century and came to a point where it ultimately was stamped out. But Jesus set the stage when he said, we go back here to Revelation 6 in this frame, and he talked about this first horseman who he said, "Behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." And in Christ's time, that began to develop, and it evolved through the centuries. Probably the critical turning point came in the 4th century with the conversion of this Roman emperor, Constantine, to Christianity. And this took place in the 4th century, in the 300s, when he converted to Christianity, and the Roman Empire began to rule over the state. And you had a state-dominated religion from that point on. That is a fascinating story that begins to unfold. But it really sets the stage for these events in the book of Revelation, and so much of the prophecies that are going to be fulfilled of a state-dominated and state-controlled religion. The stories of what Constantine did with the Council of Nicaea and subsequent councils that were called to ratify and to establish teaching and doctrine within the church, much of which we understand has false overtones and tenets and that do not represent the truth, set the stage for Christianity to develop through the ages and this combination of church and state, which again, America has been the unique shining light in our modern world where we finally broke that bond. And with the wisdom of our founding fathers, they set up within the Constitution that guaranteed by that amendment that we would not have a state-controlled religion. That has been one of the remarkable keys to our success as a people. And again, it has aided the work of God and the flourishing of the Church of God through American history as well. That we found a place where the truth could be preserved and the work of God be done in the way that it has been done in our lifetime to the extent that it has, based from a land that guaranteed a freedom of religion. We never ever want to take that for granted. And because history shows us that whenever the state begins to control religious thought and teaching, a tyranny follows thereafter. And that is developed. I've been reading a book about called God's Continent, and it's talking about the state of religion on the European continent. So much of the conventional wisdom is that Europe is a godless, postmodern continent where religion does not have much influence. And in some ways, that's true. And like any subject, there's more to it, and it's more complicated than one statement or just one headline. Religion has waned in Europe in recent years. There's no question about that. The recent European Union Constitution that was now just recently finally ratified, or at least signed by the heads of state, did not have any mention of religion in its preamble. The Catholic Church wanted to see some mention of Christianity as the historic basis and foundation of Europe there, and it wasn't put in. And that much to their regret. So that does symbolize, at least at one level, the antagonism toward religion and the desire to move away from it. But as this book, God's Continent, has been bringing out, religious faith has not died out in Europe. And whether it's Muslims or Christians or others, there are strong strains yet there at the base level within Europe that are, in a sense, just waiting for some water to be poured on them to cause those dried up roots, those shriveled up roots of Christianity in one case, in the predominant case, to once again burst forth and come alive. And the title of the book, God's Continent, does say it all, because Christianity has historically ruled over the European continent. Bible prophecy shows us that it is going to once again have come to the fore in that area. And it's important, again, just to understand that these things are they're more complicated than a simple article or a headline and an idea might give to us. And we need to understand that there's more to it. What had happened during the time of Constantine was the kingdoms of this world became came under the kingdom of the state and of the church. And they interpreted Revelation 11:15 to have been fulfilled through the combination of church and state in the time of the Roman Empire. And we are moving toward a time when we're going to see this once again develop, where the idea of Jesus sitting on a throne, as this particular statue shows in front of one building in Europe, holding a cross in one hand that is over a globe, which symbolizes the world, and you have the chief religious figure of the Pope kneeling at his right hand, and the head of the Holy Roman Empire, in this case depicted as Charlemagne, kneeling at his left, and you have this combination of church and state under the rule of Christ. That was for centuries how that was interpreted, that the church had taken over and fulfilled what the prophecy of Revelation talked about. And through the church, the Holy Roman Empire, those things were fulfilled, and their efforts were meant to advance the cause of the kingdom through time. And that's why when Christ said false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. this particular scripture points us down into the very end of the end time, as Jesus in Matthew 24, verse 24, pointed to a time when religion was once again going to have a dominant role in the world that would be, if possible, able to even deceive the very elect, the elect, the church. People like you and I, who know the truth, who understand the true gospel, the truth of the kingdom of God, the truth of these scriptures, and yet we could yet be susceptible to this deception. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 talks about a man of sin being revealed, a son of perdition that is going to sit in the temple calling himself God, a time of future religious deception. These are times that are ahead of us. And again, these scriptures point to, again, the time of wars of religion, of religious turmoil that is creeping ever slowly and rising to a level in our world. And I think we are seeing the elements of that take place in all of these things that I've showed you to set the stage for some of these prophecies to come to pass in the future that will astound the world and, if possible, even deceive the people of God, the elect of God. And it is a very critical area in which to watch and to understand. Revelation 13 talks about the powerful religious figure that is to arise. And if I can take just a brief moment to go back to Revelation 13, take you back there with me and look at that. This is a key chapter that talks about two beasts that rise up. And it really is talking about a political and religious figure symbolized by these two beasts. This first beast of Revelation 13 is a political figure who arises out of the sea, in Revelation 13, verse 1, and is worshipped. His power comes, in verse 4, we are told, from the dragon. It represents a system that had a wound that was healed, and the world marveled at the beast. Verse 4, they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast. This is the political entity that is on the rise and is going to ultimately reveal itself in the European area. And the world will say, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. In verse 7, it talks about the fact that this power is going to make war with the saints and overcome them. The spiritual struggle that lies ahead for the people of God, the saints, is something, sometimes it's a bit beyond our imagination, but it is very real. It's something we again, need to take note of, that there is a struggle that we deal with at one level today, but it is going to rise in the future as this system makes war with the saints. Revelation 12 talks about that in another context as well. But beginning with verse 11, there is this figure of another beast that arises. And this is a great spiritual leader that comes up. It has horns like a lamb, and it speaks like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he does this through performing signs that even to the point of making fire come down from heaven in the sight of men to deceive those who dwell on the earth by those signs which were granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And so the spiritual entity, this religious figure, causes the world to worship this political figure that we read about in chapter 13. What is interesting to note is in verse 15. I just wanted to focus on that for a minute. And it says, he was granted power, the second beast, to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. This spiritual leader is going to breathe life, to give breath to the image of the beast. You read that, you think of God breathing life into the first man back all the way back in Genesis. This spiritual leader is going to breathe some type of energy and life and dominance into this political structure that it doesn't have at that point. The political structure has a great deal of power, But it will be given something, make a quantum leap, it seems, by the breath that is given to it by this second beast, this religious entity, this religious figure that arises. And I just point that out to illustrate to us, again, the power of religion in our world today on the rise should not be discounted. And we need to be understanding and looking at this as strongly as we possibly can. And understanding our world, holding fast to our faith so that we ourselves are not deceived when these things take place, because all of this religious deception, if Jesus says that it could be even possible to deceive the elect, then it gets down to each one of us asking, how strong is our faith? Do we really love the truth? Do we really have a passion and a zeal for the truth of God, for Jesus Christ, for God and His work, and the truth and the gospel, and the work and the calling that we have? We come here to these weekends and occasions like this to be reinforced with one another through our fellowship, through all the teaching and spiritual instruction that we have. Let's never take that for granted. Let's keep one eye firmly planted on ourselves in that way, and with the other one, let's understand our world, what's taking place. The world is in a religious turmoil and ferment right now, and we've had a little bit of a taste of that on our own shores. We may yet see more. But certainly other areas of the world are going to see an increased and heightened awareness of religion, even to the point of peace. And that probably will be where the deception could be as strong for any of us as anything else, to see that religion, to see those efforts result in a peace that is no peace, but at least an ephemeral peace that could cause us perhaps even to doubt what we believe. In many ways, as we see these things take place. So there's a lot going on in that way in terms of religion, a lot to be aware of, and this particular presentation is just meant to bring you up to date on some of these things that are taking place to heighten that awareness.